The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
A couple of weeks ago, a trenching rain battered the dense tropical forest of northern Thailand. It's a seasonal rain. Streams downward. Flash floods fill caves, destroy crops. It's the rainy season, and it lasts until October. Well, 12 boys and their 25-year-old coach found themselves trapped in one of the caves, 2.5 miles from the entrance. Inside the cave, it's dark, it's cold, and the boys can hear the clamor of rain stomping on the earth outside. They can hear the slow creep of water inching upward. The boys all hunch. They're cold in their red jerseys, each one with a number over the upper left side, but they remain calm. The boys meditate. Their coach is trained in meditation as a Buddhist monk for a decade. He went to live in a monastery when he was 12 after being orphaned. The boys range in age from 11 to 16, and their coach is known to be a guy who has put together a tight-knit group who go on adventures, and they go swimming, which is unusual for kids. They swim in waterfalls, cycling trips, through the mountains, they river raft, and they cave explore. They had survived for 10 days before they were discovered. Now imagine, 2 weeks in a cave, muddy, clouded, dark, dark water, the haunted green murk, tiny spires underwater. It'd probably be pretty cool if it wasn't a matter of life and death. In the middle was a narrow flooded passage, the winding sharp fangs of the cave and the engulfing caverns. The rescue effort began on Sunday. Former Thai Navy SEAL died last week, setting up an escape route. Seasonal rains have ravaged the dense jungles, relenting only long enough for a thick fog to drape over the area. A squad of more than 100 divers in dark uniforms with tinges of reflective ultraviolet yellow of safety gear with bright yellow helmets and headlamps. The divers followed a thick yellow oxygen tube the width of a bumper. At the midpoint, the divers had to climb a sharp, slippery jut of rock using full climbing gear. Each boy had to wear scuba gear with breathing tanks. The breathing tanks were carried by the Navy SEALs. They were kind of pulled or swam through the curvatures in the dark, the cavernous waters, through the cramped chambers, the spiked passageways. One passageway was no more bigger than 2 feet around, too narrow for the scuba tanks. So each boy was escorted by two divers. The boys emerged from the cave. The last one was pulled out yesterday, draped in hypothermia blankets. Some of the boys were well enough to ask for their favorite dish, spicy pork stir-fried with basil. We're not sure if this is a miracle or science or what. All of the 13 wild boars are now out of the cave. Now, that's what a post to the Navy SEALs Facebook page said, the name of the soccer team. But everybody is safe. Last night, the boys were out. Monks in saffron robes and wooden slippers meditated over the boys, praying for health, for calm, and for peace.
It's Wednesday, July 11th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
That's really a remarkable story, isn't it?
Amazing.
It really is truly an amazing story.
The part where they couldn't fit through the opening with the tanks on their back is incredible, because they take them off, then they get through there, then they put them back on. The climbing gear they had to climb over certain areas. Just an incredible story.
How did somebody find out where they were? Do you know?
I don't.
Because you couldn't have gotten a signal out of there.
No. It was 2.5 miles back, right?
Marissa, can you figure out how they did that? I mean, they'd been there for 10 days before somebody figured it out.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And, kind of lost in the shuffle seems to be this Navy SEAL who died, gave his life trying to save the kids.
Somebody came in, and one of the Navy SEALs came in and had to give some of them swimming lessons. It's apparently very unusual for children in Thailand to swim.
Yeah.
And to swim, not only, I mean, we think of these caves as anything you would see in a movie. I don't think this cave was like that.
Mm-mm.
This cave was not like this. And the water was mud.
Yeah, you couldn't see anything. So that couldn't have been a fun adventure.
You couldn't
have, had to be frightening.
You couldn't have done it.
No.
You're so claustrophobic.
Oh my gosh.
You wouldn't have gotten in. But if you had gotten in, there's no way you would have gotten out.
Uh-uh. They would have had to
tranquilize you.
Which I guess some of the kids were. They gave them sedatives so that they wouldn't panic on the way out. Because if you panic, that might take the life of a Navy SEAL that's trying to help you get out, too. So I think they did drug the kids to get them out. Fascinating story.
Oh, Marissa said they found the gear outside of the cave. That's how they figured it out. But imagine that, though.
Amazing.
You find the gear outside of the cave. You can go in. You don't know that they're 2.5 miles in.
Right. Yeah. And
this is a remarkable story.
I think at one point they were thinking about drilling down to them through the... But that would, I guess, taken too long. But that's how they would have had to get me out of there, because I'm not going through the tunnels.
You really would. If you wouldn't have, they'd have to hit you with
a
dart.
I'll just stay here.
You would.
I'll stay till October. We'll see you then.
I don't think so. I don't think.
Can you send me a blanket and some food?
How long do you think the flashlights lasted? I mean, it would be one thing if you were there. I don't know when you start to lose hope. 10 days is a long time.
And
most societies and people and groups break down 72 hours. If help doesn't come within 72 hours, you begin to believe it's not coming. So, I mean, they're a long way past that.
That's what makes me believe that 25-year-old coach was a hero, because he must have kept them together. He must have. And I'm not sure what they survived on for 10 days either. There's no way they could have had provisions for 10 days when they went in there. They weren't planning on that. I haven't heard that story either. What did you live on for 10 days before somebody finally got to you and got you?
And so,
supplies?
Excuse me, because I was on vacation while all of this happened, but they were in... Were they planning on staying overnight or something? How fast did this water just...
Really fast.
Really fast, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Flash flooding. And they apparently weren't planning on it, but that can happen at any time during monsoon season. So it reminds me of some of the canyons in Utah that people hike through. And, there's warnings all over the place. Watch for flash floods, because they can come up at any time. People don't believe it, and then they drown. Because they go into these narrow passageways and they fill up immediately with water. Sometimes,
Lived in Arizona for a while. The flash floods there were crazy. In Phoenix, you'd just be driving down the road and all of a sudden you're in this giant ditch, And if, if you're in Arizona and you're in the desert and you're not even thinking, and you've lived there for 6 months and you've never seen anything like this, it's just a little dip in the road. You don't even think about it. And it is always marked warning, flash flood, wash. And so people will go down and they'll get stuck in that as the water, and it will just push their car down. I mean, all of a sudden you're
In trouble.
In real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how fast that water can come. Okay, let's go to Europe and Donald Trump. He was over having breakfast this morning with the NATO leaders. And I have to tell you, this is the first time that, because I, you know, I've said that I like a lot of the stuff that he does, and a lot of the stuff he does I don't like. It's generally when he's talking that I don't like it, you know? Mm-hmm. Today is the first day that I heard him do something that is really controversial that I don't think any other president, except maybe Reagan, would have done. And come around to the end of it and go, that was completely lucid.
Mm-hmm.
That was, it was well stated. He made a good argument. He had a good comeback.
Just to set the scene, they're at a NATO breakfast. All the leaders are lined up at this long table, and there's press there, obviously. And
yeah.
He starts talking to the press.
And he starts saying some truth about NATO. I want you to hear this next when we come back. So Pat and I were talking before we went on the air. He said, man, I wish I would have bought cryptocurrency when it was 300, 500,
700,
1,000, 2,000,
3,000, 4.
We've been talking about cryptocurrency for a while on this program, and I do believe that it is the future. And there are some things that are coming up now that are dramatically changing Bitcoin and all of the technology around it. Now, we put together a course that you can go and see this course with a guy from the Palm Beach Letter. His name is Tika Tiwari. He's a really great teacher. He's a hedge fund investment guy that left when he saw the writing on the wall of cryptocurrency. And he's made a fortune on cryptocurrency and helped others become very, very wealthy on it as well. It's really a difficult thing to understand, and that's why we put the course together. But on Thursday, that's a week from tomorrow, we're doing a BeckCryptoShow.com. Now, it's absolutely free. All you have to do is register. You register to watch it, and you'll be able to watch it. We're going to do it here in the studios, and we're going to be taking questions and everything else. But he's got a few things that he is going to outline. He is not only going to take questions and answers and give you some of the basics, but if you register now at BeckCryptoShow.com, he's also going to be sharing the names of three cryptocurrencies that he says that you have to buy. You'll also have a chance at a $2 million giveaway. All you have to do is go to BeckCryptoShow.com, register now so you don't miss anything. Again, it's free, but you have to register, and we will see you a week from tomorrow, BeckCryptoShow.com. All right, we have to separate a couple of things on this speech that Donald Trump gave this morning, or, you know, just a conversation with the NATO countries. He's having breakfast with him. Now, this is going to be said by the press. Oh, my gosh. Look, he's just folding in to Russia. He's giving Russia everything he wants because Russia wants the end of NATO. OK, well, that's true. But let's separate that truth from what Donald Trump was doing. Now, listen to what he's saying here and how he said it. It's extraordinary.
Many countries owe us a tremendous amount of money from many years back where they're delinquent, as far as I'm concerned, because the United States has had to pay for them. So if you go back 10 or 20 years, you'll just add it all up. It's massive amounts of money is owed. The United States has paid and stepped up like nobody. This has gone on for decades, by the way. This has gone on for many presidents, but no other president brought it up like I bring it up.
The good news is that the allies have started to invest more in...
This is the Secretary General of NATO responding to him, sitting right across the table from him.
Defense. After years of cutting defense budgets, they have started to add billions to the defense budgets. And last year was the biggest increase in defense spending across Europe and Canada in a generation.
Why was that last year?
It's also because of your leadership, because your carried message. And
they won't write that.
You notice that he says, so why did you increase your spending last year? And Stoltenberg, the Secretary General, says, well, it's in part because of your leadership.
Right.
They won't print that.
Right.
Meaning the press, of course, isn't going to say anything good.
Well, they
it.
Weren't there. You could hear that they weren't in the room.
I think it's very sad when Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia, mm-hmm. where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. So we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting all of these countries. And then numerous of the countries go out and make a pipeline deal with Russia where they're paying billions of dollars into the coffers of Russia. So we're supposed to protect you against Russia, but they're paying billions of dollars to Russia. And I think that's very inappropriate. And the former chancellor of Germany is the head of the pipeline company that's supplying the gas. Ultimately, Germany will have almost 70% of their country controlled by Russia with natural gas. So you tell me, is that appropriate? I mean, I've been complaining about this from the time I got in. It should have never been allowed to have happened. But Germany is totally controlled by Russia. I think it's something that
this
NATO has to look
this
at.
Is
I think it's
true.
Very inappropriate. You and I agree that it's inappropriate.
NATO is an alliance of 29 nations, and there are sometimes differences and different views and also some disagreements. And the gas pipeline from Russia to Germany is one issue where allies disagree. But the strength of NATO is that despite these differences, we have always been able to unite around our core task to protect and defend each other, because we understand that we are stronger together than apart. I think that two world wars and the Cold War taught us that we are stronger together than apart.
But how can you be together when a country is getting its energy from the person you want protection against or from the group that you want protection?
Because we understand that when we stand together, also when dealing with Russia, we are stronger. I think what we have seen is that...
No, you're just making Russia richer. Well, you're not dealing with Russia, you're making Russia richer.
Well, so I think that even during the Cold War, NATO allies were trading with Russia. Then there have been disagreements about what kind of trade arrangements we should,
sure.
should go
I think
into.
Trade is wonderful. I think energy is a whole different story. I think energy is a much different story than normal trade. And you have a country like Poland that won't accept the gas. You take a look at some of the countries, they won't accept it because they don't want to be captive to Russia. But Germany, as far as I'm concerned, is captive to Russia because it's getting so much of its energy from Russia. So we're supposed to protect Germany, but they're getting their energy from Russia. Explain that. And it can't be explained, you know.
I just love it. I love it.
Awesome.
I love it. It is. He was.
Awesome.
He was clear.
Yeah.
He was cogent.
He was right.
He's right. You know. And who's going to say that to NATO?
Nobody.
Not only. Hey, you got to pay your fair share. But why are we protecting Germany if Germany will go and take their oil and their gas and be beholden to the country mm-hmm. that we're protecting them from?
All they have to do is threaten to shut off that pipeline.
Right. And they fold.
They fold. Immediately.
Right. It's why Poland and Georgia and I think the Ukraine are completely off of mm-hmm. Russian oil. They don't want any of that gas. They don't want any of that oil. And they don't want it because they know all they have to do is shut the pipeline off and we freeze to death in the winter.
Right. Right. Everything Trump said there is show me where the fault is. I mean, that's all true. Now, if you're worried about NATO shaking apart over it, I just don't think that's going to happen. So if that's what you think is going to happen because of what he said there, then maybe he is playing into Putin's hand. But they're not going to, that's not going to break up the NATO alliance just because he said that to them. It's a pretty weak alliance if it does break up over that.
And I'm wondering if there's anything that Germany could do to solve this. Like, buy the natural gas from us.
Right. Seems like
that's where Poland's buying it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of kills two birds with one stone. And I mean, it was Reagan that said the whole collapse of the Soviet Union will be worth nothing if Russia ever builds pipelines and Europe allows themselves to become beholden to Russia.
I don't know if there will ever be a more exciting investment opportunity than cryptocurrencies. And it's certainly the most exciting one that I've seen in my lifetime. We're talking about incredible gains that have happened over the past few years. Some incredible roller coaster rides, sometimes up, sometimes down. But if you want to get involved in this, you got to check it out with a level head, and you got to go to somebody who knows what they're talking about. That's why they put together this really cool thing coming up. It's on July 19th. It's called the BeckCryptoShow.com. BeckCryptoShow.com is a place to go to register for a free event. This is going to be Glenn Beck, of course, talking to cryptocurrency expert Tika Tiwari from Palm Beach Letter. He's going to walk you through the new case for Bitcoin. He's going to give you the names of three cryptocurrencies that he recommends you should buy right now, the new training, and also possibility of getting involved in the $2 million Bitcoin giveaway. Go to BeckCryptoShow.com and register for this free event to make sure you don't miss out on a thing. It's BeckCryptoShow.com.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Do you remember the name Cody Wilson? If you've watched this program or listened to this program for a while, you'll remember him as the guy who said this.
In whose conception, under what paradigm, I'm just resisting. What am I resisting?
I don't know.
The collectivization of manufacture, the institutionalization of the human psyche. I'm not sure. But I can tell you one thing. This is a symbol of reversibility. They can never eradicate the gun from the earth.
So weird, because I was thinking the exact same thing.
That's what I got up thinking this morning.
Right when he said it.
Yeah.
Took the words right out of my mouth. Anyway.
So he was a guy who I followed that with, I think, something along the lines of, I don't even know what you just said, and I'm not sure you're a good guy or a bad guy. He's a guy who is a crypto anarchist. He is a free market guy and a strong defender of the Second Amendment. And what he was talking about, now this is 5 years ago, what he was talking about was, I can print a gun. And if I 3D print a gun, is that against the law?
I don't know. Is it the collectivization of manufacture?
Right.
The institutionalization of the human psyche? I'm not sure.
He went out and he printed 100 guns. Now, this is number 15 that came out of the printer, and I'm holding it, if you happen to be watching this program on the internet. There. That's a 1911.
That's got some heft to it.
That is if I handed that to you, would you have any idea that was 3D printed?
Absolutely not.
Right.
I would expect 3D printed to be plastic, to be lightweight.
Right.
And this is metal.
And look at it. You can see, when you look up close, you can see how it was printed. Can you see how it was printed? Look at maybe the handle. The handle is kind of on the side.
Oh, yeah.
So you can see how it was.
Yeah.
It was 3D printed. It's a 3D printed gun.
So amazing.
So there were 100 of these made at the time. And that got him into an awful lot of trouble with the United States government and Barack Obama. And Barack Obama said, you can't do that. They put him almost on a terrorist list. They claimed that he was, I think they said that he was an arms dealer, an international arms dealer. I mean, he was in a lot of trouble.
And Wired magazine called him one of the 15 most dangerous people in the world. And one of the 5 most dangerous people on the internet. That's
remarkable.
Amazing.
So now what he was really going after was something I disagree with him on, is can you print schematics? Can you just take all of the schematics of anything, which would be a violation of copyright laws, and you have a right to have a copyright? If I've spent my time and money doing it, you don't have a right to take my idea and make money from it. This is where the anarchist part of him comes out. He believes that everyone should have the right to any idea and be able to print it. Well, that stops people. We know this. It stops people from inventing. That's really one of the secrets of America. we were the ones who came up with a copyright. It was Ben Franklin who did it. And that empowered the person who was just in their, you know, their barn tinkering to come up with something, because they knew if they could copyright it, then they could make money off of it. And so people were motivated to think out of the box and create something different, and to put their time and their money in it, because it could change their lives and could eventually change other people's lives. So he wants that gone. But that's not really what this court case was about. The court case has just been settled. It was just settled in Bellevue, Washington. The Department of Justice and Second Amendment Foundation have reached a settlement in the lawsuit. SAF and Defense Distributed had filed a suit against the State Department under the Obama administration, challenging a May 2013 attempt to control public speech as an export under the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. So what this was is they were saying he is violating an arms agreement because he is putting things out on the internet that can now go all around the world, and he's basically exporting arms. Under the terms of the settlement, the government has agreed to waive its prior restraint against the plaintiffs, allowing them to freely publish the 3D files and other information at issue. The government has also agreed to pay a significant portion of plaintiffs' attorney fees and return $10,000 in State Department registration dues paid by the Defense Distributed as a result of the prior restraint. Okay, so the big news isn't even, I haven't even gotten to the big news yet. So the first thing that happened was, now the genie is officially out of the bottle, because now the government has lost a lawsuit and has settled this, saying, one, you can distribute the 3D schematics to print your own weapon. Cody, when he was here 5 or 6 years ago, said, once that happens, the gun debate is over. Now, I think the gun debate has been over for a long time because of 3D printing. But now you can, without becoming a criminal, distribute the plans to print arms. That's a pretty big deal. The second part is bigger. Significantly, the government expressly acknowledges that non-automatic firearms up to a 50 caliber, including modern semi-auto sporting rifles, such as the popular AR-15 and similar firearms, quote, are not inherently military.
Wow.
Not only is this a First Amendment victory for free speech, it also is a devastating blow to the gun prohibition lobby. For years, anti-gun people have contended that modern semi-automatic, fully sport utility rifles are so-called weapons of war. And with this settlement, the government has acknowledged that they are nothing of the sort. Under this settlement, the government will draft and pursue regulatory amendments that eliminate control for the technological information going across the internet. They will transfer export jurisdiction to the Commerce Department, which does not impose prior restraint on public speech, and that will allow Defense Distributed and SAF to publish information about 3D technology. This is huge. So the guy who, I still don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy, has done something remarkable that makes it really almost impossible for guns to ever now go away. You can't talk about, well, I'm just, you don't make them anymore. We're going to go after the manufacturer. Well, you can't anymore, because as long as you have a 3D printer, you can now make a gun.
Well, it's a symbol of reversibility, that the gun can never be eradicated from the face of the earth.
Is that really what it is? or
is it the collectivization of manufacturing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could go back and forth on that all day long.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Jonah Goldberg's joining us here in just a few minutes. Let me tell you about Casper. Casper Mattress is just a great mattress. And they'll give you a 100-day test drive. You're not getting that with anything else. I don't know about you. I have a really bad back, and I've purchased a car before, a GMC, and I had a really hard time because I have a bad back. It was fine until I drove that thing for about a month, and then my back was just killing me because of the seats. What do? You can't have a 100-day test drive. The other thing, you spend more time in bed than in your car. You get a 100-day test drive with a Casper mattress. 100 nights to sleep on it every night to see what it feels like after you've slept on it night after night after night. I think this, I mean, for me at least, it has provided the right pressure relief, the right alignment. My back doesn't feel bad when I get out and get up from bed. It ships right free to your door. You don't have to sweat any of this because it's a little teeny box. You open it up. Please open it up in the bedroom because it's a full-size mattress, and you're going to be surprised at how little that box is and how big it gets quickly once you open it up. But you don't have to jam it back into a box. If you don't like it, they're going to come and pick it up for free, give you a full refund, no questions asked. They want you to have a great night's sleep, and they believe in this mattress as much as I do. 100 nights in your home. Test it out yourself at Casper.com. Take their sleep challenge now. Casper.com. Use the promo code Beck. You'll save $50 on select mattresses now. Promo code Beck at Casper.com. Terms and conditions do apply. Could I just ask a question about the most puzzling media question I have heard in a very long time? Could you please play the audio of Mike Pence, please?
Mm-hmm. In 2006, Brett Kavanaugh testified that Roe versus Wade is settled law. You campaigned extensively on the notion that Roe versus Wade should be consigned to the ash heap of history. Are you worried that he's not going to follow what you want to do?
Well, Dan, as you know, I'm pro-life. I don't apologize for it. And I'm proud to be part of a pro-life administration that's advanced pro-life policies. But what I can assure you is that what the president was looking for here was a nominee who will respect the Constitution as written, who will faithfully uphold the Constitution in all of his interpretations of the law.
Do you still want Roe versus Wade to be overturned?
Well, I do, but I haven't been nominated to the Supreme Court.
Right,
I
mean, but you're Judge part of the administration has. That campaigned, you and the president
That's
campaigned,
right.
saying
right.
you will find nominees to overturn Roe versus Wade. Will you be disappointed if he is given that opportunity and he doesn't? Will you be disappointed?
Well, let me say, as I said, I stand for the sanctity of life. This administration, this president, are pro-life. But, you know, what the American people ought to know is that, as the president said today, this is not an issue that he discussed with Judge Kavanaugh. I didn't discuss it with him either. What we really focused
Why?
On was the character, the background, the credentials, and the judicial philosophy.
But again, you campaigned so aggressively on finding a nominee who would overturn Roe versus Wade.
So ridiculous.
Do you feel confident? Can you assure the people who voted for you on that notion that this is the man who will do that?
Well, what I can assure people that voted for us is that this will continue to be a pro-life administration.
Now, this is like going to Cecile Richards and saying, are you still for Roe versus Wade?
Yeah.
I mean,
it is.
Yeah. Yes. I'm the head of Planned Parenthood. Yes, I'm still for it. This is a guy who has always been for life, always, unabashedly, doesn't have a problem saying it. And now they're pitting him, and the headline is, he's still pro-life.
Well, obviously he is. Why would that change?
And I don't like the fact that we mince words on this. If you believe that abortion is murder, which I do believe, and I have sympathy, and I feel so horrible for some of the women that find themselves in this situation where they feel like that's the only out. Others you know, what's being promoted now, where it's just like, hey, I'm going to go do whatever I want and don't worry about it. I'm going to have an abortion. That's just, you're a murderer. You're just a serial killer. And with, without any remorse at all. I mean, anyway, why should we be afraid to say, yeah, I'll be disappointed?
We shouldn't. There's no reason in the world. It's like we've talked about before that we were kind of put off the subject because it was too controversial. It didn't go anywhere. It caused too much rancor. So stop talking about it on talk radio. It's just not a good talk radio topic. And I think we made a big mistake in going along with that reasoning for a long time. Well, then we realized how important it is to just keep talking about things because it can change people's minds. Look what happened with the movement of same sex. It was 65 to 35 against in the late 90s and early 2000s. It's 65-35 in favor now. Why? Because they were unabashedly, unashamedly pushing for it really hard and never stopped.
And also using comedy.
Yeah.
They also used comedy and tried to make people, you know, to take people who were gay and show them that they nothing to be afraid.
They normalized
to be afraid of here.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing wrong with normalizing homosexuality. I mean, there's nothing wrong with showing if you're a homosexual, you're just like everybody else. But that was the linchpin. Because the other side was making it about gay marriage instead of saying the government doesn't have a place in anybody's marriage, in anybody's marriage. We would have so short circuited all of this crap about the First Amendment, not only speech, but First Amendment protection of religion. Had we said this has no place in government, no place. You can go get married, you know, you go marry a tree if you want to. Do what you want to do. We'll do what we do. Do not try to tell my church or my arborist who they can and cannot marry, period.
Mm-hmm.
If we would have done that, we would have had a different outcome. This one, we're sitting here and they are starting to normalize now. That's what's happening with all these abortion jokes.
Yeah.
Is they're starting to make it funny. If they succeed on this, the value of life will go down dramatically.
Glenn Beck. It's Wednesday, July 11th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
One of the great thinkers of our times is Jonah Goldberg, best-selling author of Liberal Fascism, a book that changed my life. He's got a new book out. It's been out for a while. It's great. It's called Suicide of the West. Welcome to the program, Jonah. How are you?
Hey, Glenn. It's great to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. We just heard Donald Trump over with the NATO allies, and he said, you know, you guys got to start paying your way. And why should we be defending Germany when you're taking all of your oil in Germany or your gas from Russia? How does that make any sense? You're empowering them and then asking us to protect you from them. Did you hear that?
Yeah,
and do you think he has good point?
I think he has a point. I think he's got a bunch of points. Some of them are good. Some of them are pretty well grounded in previous, you know, complaints from other administrations about you know, European allies and NATO not carrying the load. I think that's all fine. I don't necessarily love the way he did this morning. I think it'll play very well politically back here at home.
Mm-hmm.
But there are ways to chastise allies that I think are probably...
like, how would you have said that? I mean, I listened to him, and it's the first time that I... You know, I like some of the stuff he does, some of the stuff I don't like, and it's usually when he's talking or tweeting that I don't like it. This time he seemed well grounded, well founded, and just spoke clearly and plainly.
Yeah, it also seemed, and look, there are two ways to look at this. On the merits of what he was actually saying, I'm pretty much with him, right? I thought the pipeline deal was a bad deal. I don't think it was a bad deal because it was robbing us of sales that we couldn't make. We can't get natural gas in those volumes to Europe anyway. That's a bit of a red herring. But it was a bad deal because, and Germany does have too many ties with Russia. But the tone and tenor and the way he did it, refused to walk out on the blue carpet, the way he sort of belittled an ally, the merits of his case are probably less important than the body language and the tone, because so much of what he says the EU is worse than NAFTA. He goes out, he says that NATO isn't worth it anymore, that these people are deadbeats. And that is sowing discord in the most successful military alliance in human history. And that seems to be the way that the tone and tenor of it seems to be pitched at that. By all means, I want, look, I mean, there is this sort of time-tested thing about how things go bad when Germany's defense budget goes up. but as a general proposition, by all means, I want these guys to spend more money on their defense budgets. But this idea that somehow NATO, or that the EU even, you know, are designed to take advantage of America, which is something he says all the time, I just don't think is true. And the fact that he is much more willing to lavish praise on dictators, authoritarians, and essentially enemies of the United States, while throwing, you know, leaders of allied countries under the bus and ridiculing them, I think, like, I don't think there was a lot of Russia collusion. I think the Russia collusion story has always been sort of too cute by half, and I've never bought into it. But this stuff of sowing discord in the Western alliance, undermining the legitimacy of NATO, undermining of our relationships with our key allies, this is all music to Vladimir Putin's ears. And we should at least tread carefully. Europe was the source of instability and bloodshed, the likes of which no continent has matched for half a millennia. And it was only with the bloodshed that they created in World War I and World War II, and then with the rise of the Soviet Union, and the only thing that has sort of kept that entire region a zone of peace is American will imposed through NATO. And the idea that somehow we can just, you know, willy-nilly throw it away based upon the fact that they're not paying enough dues, NATO doesn't work that way anyway, it just seems to me to be taking quite a flyer. But by all means, Bob Gates, lots of these guys used to grill NATO and say, you need to pay up more, you need to pay more into your national defense. But, let's not lose sight of the fact that this alliance, which won World War II and won the Cold War, has real value for the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And is not just simply a bunch of Euro weenies playing us for suckers.
I would agree with that, but let me slightly change gears here. Brexit.
Sure.
I see what's happening in Brexit, and Russia is behind some of this with Brexit. They're just using they're using what some people are feeling, and they are exploiting it for their own purposes. But it's real what people in Europe are feeling. And this nationalism, while it is really, really frightening, it is important to recognize it as something inherently human. I know you talk a lot about nationalism,
sure.
But there is something to be said about being proud. And there's a fine line between, hey, I'm proud of who we are, and nationalism.
No, I agree with that entirely. Look, my attitude towards nationalism has always been sort of like one of the analogies I often use is salt, right? All poisons are determined by the dose. Diet Coke is poisonous if you drink enough of it. Everything is poisonous if you eat enough of it, right? But you take salt, right? A little salt brings the meal together. It binds the flavors together. A little nationalism is essential for society to have a sense that this country is mine, there may be others like it, but this one is special to me. It gives you a sense of social solidarity, community, brotherhood, sisterhood, whatever you want to call it. It binds you together to your community, to the largest community, that matters. That's all fine. And I think a country without a little nationalism would be a hot mess. But too much nationalism, it starts to go the other way, and way too much nationalism, it becomes lethal and poisonous.
Correct.
I don't think we're anywhere close to that yet. there are certainly some very toxic voices for nationalism out there, you know, under the rocks of Twitter and we're not and comment sections. But I just think you have to be, you have to sort of take it carefully about what sort of rhetoric and what sort of movements you encourage. I think, look, I've been against the European Union. I've been against cosmopolitanism my entire professional life.
Mm-hmm.
I very much prefer, in the American context, talking about patriotism over nationalism, because patriotism is a body of ideas and creeds and customs that you can sort of identify. Nationalism is too close to populism to me, which basically just says whatever we the people want is right. And but I understand there's some fuzziness in the definitions there, and not all nationalism and patriotism aren't at odds necessarily.
I don't think you could. You have a hard time pulling patriotism and nationalism apart now because we don't need our creeds. I mean, you make a really good point in your book about, you know, how these truths are not self-evident. You want to go into that?
Right. Sure. Look, I mean, so the basic thesis of the book, or the basic setup for the book, is what I try to do is work on the terms of the sort of secular, modern, progressive left, whatever you want to call it, not the left, but just sort of like where the conversation is in America. I don't make appeals to the, I believe in God, but I don't say that God is responsible for all of these things that we have. I basically make the point that for 250,000 years, the man's natural environment was grinding poverty, punctuated by an early death, usually from violence or some bowel-stewing disease. And if democracy, human rights, property rights, free speech, all of these things, if capitalism, if all of these things were natural, they would have showed up a little earlier in the evolutionary record. It turns out that we stumbled into, in one sense, we fought for, in another sense, all of these amazing things that come together, which I call the miracle. They include things like the Enlightenment, but also all sorts of cultural and sort of almost tribal attachments to freedom and limited government that we stumbled into and honed over the last 300 years. They're the only thing that has ever delivered man out of poverty. They're the only thing that has ever sort of improved the lot of the average human being anywhere in the world. Aristocrats have done well for a couple thousand years, mm-hmm. but the average human's lot has not improved until about 300 years ago. And so these things are embedded in our culture, but they're embedded in our creeds and our ideas. And what we need to do is teach people to be grateful for them, to appreciate them. When you're grateful for something, you take care of it. You want to pass it on to the next generation. When you take it for granted, right, sort of the opposite of gratitude is taking stuff for granted, which breeds a sense of another opposite of gratitude, which is entitlement and resentment. And we teach vast numbers of people today that they're just simply owed something, that all of the good things that we have in life, the fact that we don't die at the age of 30, you know, 100 years ago, almost every single family in America had the experience of at least one child dying. That's vanished. You know, it used to be a common occurrence in this country. Calvin Coolidge's kid got a blister on his foot playing tennis on the White House tennis court and died a week later. That was normal, and there was nothing we could do about it. We take all of those sorts of things for granted, and instead we teach people that the history of this country is defined by our worst crimes rather than our greatest triumphs, and that if you don't like the world around you, it's because someone is screwing you. And that is a deeply poisonous thing, and it is the thing that I think is a sort of suicidal choice as a civilization.
So we're seeing now the rise of democratic socialism, unlike I think we've ever seen before. Maybe around the turn of the century, it was like this. And it is really coming from youth. They are, because we haven't taught anything, they are wrapping their arms around it. As a guy who knows history, what is coming?
Oh, well, I mean, clearly the living will envy the dead. no, look, I mean, I, it's, you're absolutely right. You know, and I do think it was more intense at the beginning of the 20th century. But in defense of those guys, at least it was kind of a new idea
back then.
Right?
We have
I mean, it's like,
yes, there was no evidence that it would end in 100 million dead. Now that's all there is.
And it sounded like a pretty cool idea.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I get it.
Yeah.
Not the 100 million dead part, but like everybody living, you know, and sharing and kumbaya. And we're going to, if we all work our hardest, we'll make this the best yearbook ever. I mean, that all sounded great back then. But today, I think part of the problem is that everyone forgets the rivers of blood that were created by, you know, socialism. And in fairness, you know, not all forms of socialism lead to the gulag or even to Venezuela, right? But the only thing that prevents socialism from leading to those things is has nothing to do with socialism itself, right? I mean, the democratic and democratic socialism has to do all of the heavy lifting, because in pure socialism, you do get up, you do end up with, you know, mobs looting stores or the gulag or troops shooting people. You have to have other things that dilute and prevent the socialism from reaching its natural conclusion. And those things like constitutions and democratic checks and balances.
And quite
in
honestly,
places like Denmark, you can get some of that. But places like Denmark and Sweden really aren't socialist anymore because it didn't work for them either.
Well, but they
got better welfare states, but that's different.
But they also are homogenized. I mean, it is, up until recently, it was one tribe. Everybody kind of looked alike. They all kind of agreed. They were all together. It's easy to keep something together like that when you all think alike and you're all from the same culture. That culture brings you together. We're not that culture. We never have really been that culture. We're from all over the world. We're all immigrants. We used to come here for one idea. That idea was not socialism or collectivism. Now that idea is gone. You throw socialism on top of it when you are this split and you are headed for gulags.
Oh, no, let me put it this way. That's one, gulag is certainly one of the options. One of them is just an unbelievable hot mess. You also throw in the fact that, you know, what's her name? Alexandria Cortez, or
yes,
however you say her name. She is, she's also for open borders.
I know.
And so you open borders socialism is...
Can't be done.
It's like having screen doors in a submarine, right? I mean, it just simply doesn't work. And it used to be that at least the Bernie Sanders style socialist understood that. You know, Bernie Sanders used to decry open borders as a Koch brothers scheme to bring in cheap labor. Now the Democratic Party has kind of lost its mind and basically says, We can give you the moon, free education, free housing, free this, free that, guaranteed job, and everybody can get in the pool. And it just doesn't work that way. And so look, on the Scandinavian model, you're absolutely right. You know, like my friend Charles Murray always used to say that there's a well-established finding in the social science literature that pretty much any idea will work for a while with Swedes. And the Swedes had a profound amount of social solidarity. It's very easy to maintain a generous welfare state when a stranger's grandmother looks just like your grandmother. Mm-hmm. You know, in Sweden, this is, you know, it has always been amazing to me. In Sweden, everyone has a right to look up any other Swede's tax returns on the web. Mm. So everyone knows what everyone else makes. You know, that kind of thing is possible in a small, deeply homogenous system. It doesn't work that way in America. And it's not because Americans are racist. It's just that the whole point of America, this is what one of the things that drives me crazy, both on the right and the left these days, is the way American exceptionalism has been redefined to mean we're just better than everybody.
Yeah.
And the left hates that, and the right likes it, and both are garbage. There's an enormous amount of historical and social science literature going back 150 years on American exceptionalism. And the whole point of American exceptionalism wasn't that we were better than everybody. Seymour Martin Lipset called it a double-edged sword. On the one hand, there were a lot of good things that came with American exceptionalism. On the other hand, there were a lot of bad things. We were more violent than almost any other country because of American exceptionalism. We settled our disputes out in the West with our fists and our six guns. That was part of our thing. And there, and you know, the literature on this goes, I'll just name Werner Assange.
We've lost to Jonah Goldberg. Try to pick it up with him on the other side or have him back. Suicide of the West is the name of the book. Jonah Goldberg's Suicide of the West. Let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's Simply Safe. Simply Safe, man, they do everything they can to make sure that that alarm system is the best available. It's really amazing, the glass break technology. Glass break technology, have you ever thought, how does it not know that I am, you know, not dropping a glass in the kitchen? Believe it or not, most glass break technology from most places it can go off at a baby's cry. So they didn't want any of this. They didn't want to offer it unless it was absolutely the best and could be really accurate. So Simply Safe put together a glass break test facility that ran over 10,000 live glass break simulations. They did it until they could get their detection technology where it could distinguish between a broken plate and a broken window. The level of detail is off the charts. The price is unbelievable. Simply Safe has no contracts. You own the system. You never have to think about this thing twice. It's 24/7 monitoring with police and fire dispatch is only $15 a month. Best that you can buy. Visit SimplySafeBeck.com right now. That's SimplySafeBeck.com for the home security system where you'll save 10% off the entire product now at SimplySafeBeck.com. People are really split on the tariffs. The Dow is down another 135 points today, based on rumor that that Donald Trump is preparing more tariffs, another 10% on China. China is going to retaliate, and this is the answer to China's retaliation. Some people say that Donald Trump is just using this as a bargaining chip.
It's brilliant tactic. He's negotiating.
And maybe he is.
I hope so.
And I hope he knows how to time the market, if you will. We'll talk to Jonah Goldberg, the author of Suicide of the West. Jonah Goldberg joins us again on the other side of the commercial break. Hang on.
A home is the biggest investment you're ever going to make, right? I mean, we're talking about something that is going to make or break your financial future. And there's something important that you need to know when you go into that process. You need to know if your real estate agent's any good. A lot of times we just kind of find someone that we know, find someone we've met, maybe see an advertisement on a bench and go with that person because we see it all around town. That's not enough. You have to have somebody who's been screened, who understands everything about your local market, and that's why realestateagentsitrust.com is so important. Go to realestateagentsitrust.com, look at the over 1,200 agents they have on there, and they're going to find the best one for you in your town. We're talking about the most important aspects of any transaction, not just the paperwork, but the advertising and the way they treat their clients and the results that they get. Let these agents earn your business. Get moving with realestateagentsitrust.com. If you need to sell your house fast and for the most money, it's realestateagentsitrust.com.
Jonah Goldberg, from National Review, and also the author of a new book, Suicide of the West, which is an absolute must read. You remind me, Jonah, I would like to ask you, I want to start putting together a library of books that are essential for, you know, the study of the Republic and to be able to know, you know, what built us.
Right.
And I'd love to get some book picks from you, but let me start with trade. I'm a free trade guy. I think tariffs are an absolute nightmare. I think, you know, I know enough history to know that it was Smoot Hawley that really dragged us into the deep depression, and it doesn't usually work out well. A lot of people will say Donald Trump is using this as a tactic. How's it working out for us so far?
I think pretty badly. you know, one of my frustrations in talking about all this is that when we talk about tariffs with China, or, you know, trade with China, I absolutely have no problem with people saying the intellectual property theft from China is a problem, because it is. They've been stealing from us. They do it all the time. One of the things that really bothers me, though, is the way big corporations and CEOs say they have nothing. They agree to these agreements with Chinese companies and the Chinese government, and then they go whining about how they were forced to do it. They could say no, and they don't. And so but anyway, the intellectual property theft is a big deal. But whenever the conversation, including with friends of mine like Larry Kudlow, you know, and Stephen Moore, whenever the conversation is about China and trade, they can't defend the tariff stuff, so they immediately switch to the intellectual property theft stuff, and they're different things. Go talk to soybean farmers who in the last, I don't know, 60 days have seen the price of their crops drop by 20%. You know, the margins in agriculture are pretty tight. And it would bother me less if there was some evidence that there are actual conversations going on between China and the United States to avoid this getting worse. And there's none. I mean, what's to say is Brady, the head of the Appropriations Committee, came out with a statement today saying there is no evidence that there are any of these conversations going on. China keeps coming out with these statements saying, we're willing to talk, but you need to give us a list of the things that you want done, and the Trump administration won't do it. And ultimately, the problem with the tariff stuff is that it really boils down to just another example of picking winners and losers in the economy. And we tend to punish ourselves more than we punish other nations. Do I want there to be freer trade? Do the Europeans and the Chinese play games that I would like to get rid of? Sure. But, you know, when Donald Trump talks about you know, our trade deficit with these countries, he makes it sound as if he literally says they're robbing us of billions of dollars. That's not how trade works. Look, you know when you go to, like, Dave and Buster's and you get those tokens to play the video games?
Yes.
You can't spend those tokens anyplace other than Dave and Buster's. You can't spend U.S. dollars anyplace other than the United States of America. That's why almost any economist will tell you the flip side of a trade deficit is an investment surplus, because those dollars come back to America. That's why it's so maddening when Donald Trump talks about how these trade deficits are so terrible, and then often in the same sentence or paragraph brags about all the foreign investment that's coming into America. Well, that foreign investment has to come into America because it's in dollars. And so we don't get robbed. You know, you know, a friend of mine, Tim Carney, first pointed this out. There was this great thing where the creator of the Cronut, you know, this sort of croissant donut hybrid thing, he was like, look, I want to give back to, you know, he got really rich. He says, I want to give back to the country that, you know, made me rich and made me success, and they've been so good to me, so I want to give back. And Tim goes, you don't have to give back anything. You gave us the Cronut. <laughs> You know? <laughs> It's a fair deal.
Right.
And that's what trade is we get something. It's non-zero sum. Anyone who buys something that they want gets something that they want. And the person who sells it gets something that they want, money.
First of all, how is Larry? Have you heard from Larry Kudlow?
I have not, but the last I heard, he was definitely on the mend, and that the heart attack was pretty mild.
So is he going back to work? Because it made me feel a lot better when Larry was involved in this.
No, I agree. And I don't know. I should find out. I'm kind of glad you reminded me. I've been traveling so much. I should find out. You know, look, the Trump administration has got a lot of good people. You know, Mick Mulvaney believes in free trade. Kevin Hassett believes in free trade. Larry Kudlow. Peter Navarro doesn't, and I don't have a lot of respect for Peter Navarro. But most of these guys believe in it. The problem is the president has a very much a 1980s view about trade that might have made more sense in the 1980s when, you know, we were doing this stuff with Japan. But now he just sees it as the same problem. And supply chains don't work that way. Lots of products, you know, the ingredients to lots of products cross the U.S.-Mexican border like 20 times before the finished product, because That's how supply chains work now, and we use a hell of a lot more steel than we make. And so when you put tariffs on foreign steel, you are taxing manufacturing companies to a far greater extent than you are rewarding people who work in the steel industry.
You point out in your book, you say that capitalism, you know, everybody just assumes that it's pretty automatic. But it kind of goes back to the self-evident truths. It's not. Capitalism is not automatic.
Right. So one of the things that, you know, I originally wanted to call the book The Tribe of Liberty, and this kind of gets back to your point about Sweden from earlier.
Yeah.
Capitalism, to a serious extent, is a cultural phenomenon more than an economic phenomenon. It has embedded within it all sorts of cultural assumptions about how people should live, what the role of the family is, what the role of the individual is, about whether or not innovation is a good thing or a bad thing. And those institutions, those ideas, they emerge in England and Holland at a specific point in time, but they're not universal laws, and they don't just emerge automatically. If you put a bunch of uneducated humans in the raw on an island, they wouldn't start creating, you know, apps for Uber. They'd all grab spears and start killing each other, because that's our natural state. And so capitalism emerges out of this very English quirkiness that has a lot to do with Protestantism. It has a lot to do with Judeo-Christian tradition. And there are a lot of contributing factors to it. It also has a lot to do with the fact that the nuclear family emerges in England for reasons that it didn't emerge almost anywhere else in the world. And so when we sort of just assume that, you know, it does turn out that capitalism is exportable and that markets are exportable because they work. And so people see that it works and they adjust them to their own societies. But it is not foreordained that we have to be capitalists. Is that, in fact, biologically, it's far more, you know, ordained that we should be socialists, because that's what tribes are, is a bunch of socialists.
So how do you teach the youth that is not hearing a pro-capitalist message, except in everything they do and buy, but somehow or another they don't associate the apps and everything, all the freedoms that they have, with capitalism? How do we teach this? How do we get this to the next generation?
Yeah, I actually don't think it's very hard to teach it. I mean, I could teach this kind of stuff in my sleep, and I know lots of other people who can. The problem is, it's not so much that we don't know how to teach it, is that we don't know how to get the teachers to want to teach it. And we don't know how to get, you know, there's a reason why journalists, social workers, and teachers tend to, not uniformly, it's not an iron law, but they tend to be on the more liberal side. And it's a psychological orientation that says, if I could just get the truth out there, if I could just proselytize, I don't really care very much about getting rich, I want to do good things. It's not an evil orientation, that they go into certain, you know, into certain professions. And certainly at the graduate level, the people who run the education schools and a lot of the graduate programs, they are committed to an ideology that is just very deeply hostile to liberal democratic capitalism. And this is not a newsflash to anybody. Mm-hmm. And so if you make it out of that pipeline and you go, and this is one of the things that bothers me a lot. I talk to conservatives about this a lot. I'm very much in favor of school choice, right? Mm-hmm. But I have school choice. I send my kid to a private school in D.C. because I don't want to send my kid to D.C. public schools. And I can afford it, and I'm lucky, and I only have one kid. So, you know, I can do that, but I spend a lot of money doing it. She still gets taught a lot of this stuff.
Oh,
all my friends who send their kids to private schools get taught this stuff, too. It's not, you know, breaking up the public school monopoly
is not
has lots of advantages for it, but it doesn't solve all these problems.
Yeah. Well, it's almost impossible to come out of the pipeline with a certificate and still believe the things that, you know, we used to all believe. It just changes you. It's not being taught anywhere or very few places. Real quick, Jonah, if I put you on a desert island and I said five books that you want to take with you so you don't lose the Western civilization. You can restart the civilization, or at least understand it. What would they be?
Oh gosh, under the gun with the rule that I can change my mind later.
Yeah,
I think you got to do the full Bible, right? I think you probably need, something from the sort of Catholic tradition, either from St. Aquinas or St. Augustine, but I'm maybe City God, City Man. Then, again, if this is like the starter yeast for Western civilization, the Wealth of Nations,
yeah,
maybe the Federalist Papers, and then, of course, Suicide of the West.
very good. Bill O'Reilly would have started with, you know, killing the Nazis or whatever book he's working on.
Killing Lincoln.
Yeah, that's right. All right, thank you so much, Jonah. I appreciate it. God bless.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You bet. Jonah Goldberg, Suicide of the West, great book, and one that you should have in your library. All right, for most Americans, your home is your biggest investment. This is why there's Real Estate Agents I Trust, because working with the right agent can make a significant difference in the outcome of buying or selling your home. We have over 1,000 agents all over America who are just like you. Their word is their bond. They're fans of the show. They share your sensibilities. Our agents are fully vetted, handpicked for their knowledge, their skill, their track record. They have to know your area. They have to know what your home is worth. Thousands of families have already put Real Estate Agents I Trust to the test, and you can find out the results yourself. Go to the website, talk to one of the real estate agents in your area. Real Estate Agents I Trust. Whether you are moving, you're buying, you're selling, you're doing something out of state, Real Estate Agents I Trust are the people that you can go to that is going to get the most amount of money, the biggest bang for your buck. It's realestateagentsitrust.com.
Glenn Beck.
So let me ask you, Pat. I put you on a deserted island, and I say we want to put a bunch of books there that will help revive or understand Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
What do you put?
I think at the top of the list is Green Eggs and Ham.
No, come on.
Myrtle the Turtle's got to be in there.
Right.
Well, obviously, like Jonah said, the Bible. And Adam Smith, of course, both of his works.
Yeah.
You know, Wealth of Nations and...
And Moral Sentiments.
Yeah, yes.
Got to have Moral Sentiments.
Maybe Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand.
Oh. Which
possibly.
One?
Possibly.
Atlas Shrugged?
Probably Atlas Shrugged, yeah. It's hard, because if you can only have five...
Well, you give me more. I want to put together a library of books, a hardbound library of books that will tell the story of the entire West. Like, you know, should it be... I mean, the history of the English-speaking peoples.
Yeah.
You know?
Also, you'd need the Constitution, right? The U.S. Constitution.
Yes, you need the
got to have that foundation and the Federalist Papers, because that explains the thinking that went into the Constitution.
Right, and I think there should be something. I don't know if there's a great book that has the documents and then the best speeches from America. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like what Barack Obama gave to the Queen of England.
Exactly. That's what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
his
entire works. Maybe a little more broad than that. Maybe a little bit more. What about
is there one we're missing?
What about like Up from Slavery? What tells
that would be great. Although the left would,
I don't care.
Dispute
this is
that.
Not for the left. This is for me.
Up from Slavery is great because
Booker T. Washington.
Yeah, because there's a guy who, you know, he's really young, but he was a slave at the start of his life, and then he experienced freedom, and he loved the country.
It's one of the most compelling stories of slavery, saying that he remembers somebody coming to the plantation and saying, "You're free."
Mm-hmm.
And
he was like four.
Yeah, and it was Juneteenth. And he said, "All I remember is everyone was really excited that day. And then the next day, everybody was really afraid. They're like, what does that even mean? And he
said, where do we go? What do we do?
Yeah. And he said, even the plantation owners were the same. They were afraid. They didn't know what that meant. What's going to happen? Yeah. And he said, we found that we really needed each other. They had skills that we didn't have, and we had skills that they didn't have. And we ended up working together. And then he goes off and, you know, starts his own school. And the story of him getting into a school is phenomenal. Up From Slavery. If you've never read it, you should. Up From Slavery, Booker T. Washington. Back in just a minute.
Glenn Beck.
Let's just stop for a minute because there's been so much crap going on this week. Let me look into something that happened late Saturday night. Police in Western Montana, they got a phone call. 32-year-old man acting really strange, threatening people that he had a gun. When police came to the scene, the man was gone. Police learned that a 5-month-old boy that had been left in this man's care was missing. Short time later, police receive a call, a new tip. 911 caller spotted the man. They quickly apprehend him. The man was incoherent, apparently under the influence of drugs. Police tried to question him about the missing boy. The man only made vague statements about the baby was possibly buried someplace in the mountains. It doesn't have a happy ending, does it, Glenn? Wait. Search and rescue team quickly assembled. Officers scoured the remote woods in the dark for the next 6 hours. 2:30 in the morning, a deputy, his name is Ross Jessup, he heard a whimper. He and another officer followed the sound to a pile of sticks and debris. Underneath the sticks and debris, they found the baby boy, buried face down under the pile. The baby was shivering, clothed only in a onesie that was wet and soiled, but the boy survived. He had been alone for at least 9 hours in 46-degree night weather. Jessup said the baby was alert, exhausted, and unable to cry anymore. On the way to the hospital, the baby coughed up small sticks. He's been treated for dehydration, minor scrapes, and bruises, but believe it or not, he is in good condition. The man who left him in the woods being held on multiple charges. Yesterday, the Missoula County Sheriff's Office posted on its Facebook page, this is what we would call a miracle. Law enforcement officers can have a dreary outlook on life at times. Calls come in and you see people at their absolute worst day after day. But over the weekend, out of so much darkness came a little light. A baby was found alive. It's easier to look at the world as a dark place, but we have seen so many people come together for one single reason, humanity and life. Thank you to those who have reached out, sent prayers to this little baby. It matters. I wanted to start this hour with this story. This week has been so dominated by so much media angst over abortion rights. It's nice to be reminded that in many corners of America that no one is ever really looking at, people understand that a baby's life is still worth preserving.
It's Wednesday, July 11th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Now let me just dip our foot back into the insanity pool here for just a second. But Keith Ellison yesterday, Keith came out and he said that he won't rule out impeaching Supreme Court justices if Democrats win Congress. That's not a good precedent to set. Here he is. Listen.
Is there any possibility that the legislative branch would remove a Supreme Court justice? I know it's constitutionally possible. I also know it's never been done.
You have to find some evidence of, like, corruption, something like that. I will say that there have been lower court judges that have been impeached, you know?
Right.
And honestly, there were some things that came up with Justice Thomas that I thought were very concerning to me in terms of his impartiality. And so I agree with Jill, it's probably not going to happen, but it could theoretically happen.
So he says there's some things that, you know what? Maybe we should have impeached Clarence Thomas because he said some really crazy things. Okay. Well, let's just assume that you can't impeach people just because of their point of view. They actually have to not be doing their job. What is the job of the Supreme Court, Pat?
Let's see. To rule on constitutionality. Is a matter constitutional or is it not?
Okay.
That's the
job.
So
wait a minute. That implies that you have to use...
The Constitution. Yes, okay. The U.S. Constitution should be used.
You don't hear this clip enough, and I know we've played it on the show quite often, but I think you need to hear it again. It's Justice Ginsburg on how she looks at cases and the Constitution.
You should certainly be aided by all the Constitution writing that has gone on since the end of World War II.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I would not look to the U.S. Constitution if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012. I might look at the Constitution of South Africa. Mm. That was a deliberate attempt to have a fundamental instrument of government that embraced basic human rights, had an independent judiciary.
What a concept that would be, an independent judiciary. I guess you can only dream of a country like that.
I think we
have
one.
That, and she belongs to it, as
right.
a matter of fact.
I think we have that.
I think a great piece of work that was done much more recently than the U.S. Constitution. Canada has a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, dates from 1982. You would almost certainly look at the European Convention on Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, why not take advantage
not?
Of what there is elsewhere in the world?
Well, I would say, Ruth, one reason why not is because you are to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. When we're talking about constitutional law... We're meaning the Constitution of the United States. I don't know if you know this. We don't live in Europe or South Africa or Canada. We live here. And the Constitution you should be paying attention to would be ours.
Yeah, the one here. The one that they've been sworn to protect and defend. That one.
Yes.
There's a reason our Constitution is the oldest in existence on the planet. Because it works better than anything man has done in the history of politics and the history of putting together a government. This is the one that has held everything together for, how many civilizations have tried what we're doing? Over and over and over and over it failed. But we had the 56 men with all the wisdom and drive in the same place at the same time. Some of the greatest men in the history of this planet got together and, through, I believe, divine inspiration, came up with the best possible solution for any government ever.
I was, because I'm writing a book, comes out September 18th. You can get it now on Amazon. It is called Addicted to Outrage. And I really looked into the founders, and I looked into the founding documents. The at least 12 other countries have taken our documents and they've used our documents to start their own country.
Absolutely.
They didn't work. They didn't work. They failed. We did. We succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something more than just the documents themselves. It is the culture that those documents produced.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or or the culture that produced those documents is probably a better way of saying it. There was something different about the people here. And we are exceptional in the fact that we're the only ones that have ever been able to really do this. Everybody else had to come through all kinds of bloodshed. And everything else, we're just now deciding whether or not we want to keep the culture and we want to keep the Western way of life, how are we even having these conversations? How can we even have a conversation with Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she's talking about different constitutions and we don't even know ours?
Yeah.
We don't even know our Bill of Rights. How are we supposed to come up with something better if we don't even know what we have?
And who should know better than a U.S. Supreme Court justice whose only job is to protect and defend the Constitution and decide on the constitutionality of laws? And that's the whole job description. So there's one of the greatest reasons I've ever heard to impeach a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, Keith, you want to go down that road?
Yeah, let's start with Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's craziness. It's craziness.
And no, to my knowledge, nobody's really ever talked about this with her. I don't remember it, you know, really blowing up into a massive story in 2012 when she said all those things.
I remember we talked about it.
We did talk about it.
Yeah, but I don't remember a massive story on it.
No. And how can there not be? That's a Supreme Court justice.
Because that's the way people are going now.
Yeah.
And people don't necessarily revere the Constitution anymore.
Oh, you're right. It's old. It's old. And they were, which is another, it's just more proof of how the progressives started out and why they started out disparaging the founders. Because you had to disparage everything that came from them. And they've done such a good job of that. That you, when somebody calls into question the legitimacy of the U.S. Constitution, people think, oh, yeah, that came from those rich, old, white guys who owned slaves. And so it's been such an effective job. People don't respect the founders anymore.
You don't go there. And there's no more logical thinking. I mean, I would really like to talk to the Democratic Socialists about their plan. Let's actually hear your plan. As Jonah said, you know, you can't
get
have
it out there.
Yeah, you can't have socialism and open borders. You'd have one or the other. You can't have both.
You know, you made the prediction, this is years ago, that socialists would just come out eventually and just admit it. Yeah, we're socialist.
Yeah.
So what? And now they're doing just that.
Right.
But I thought at the time, yeah, I'll bet they will, but then they'll be rejected. You know,
no.
The American people will reject
them. Did you really think that?
I did. Wow. I did at the time. I certainly don't now. I've been proven so wrong. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a perfect example of that. And, you know, I've been talking about what a concern that is in our country, that she could be, she was so popular, she blew out a 10-term congressman to get that job. And so it shows you the embrace of socialism, I'm afraid, in our society. But people will call on my show and say, no, it's just because she's attractive and she's young. That's the appeal there. She's got charisma.
I think if I may kind of build on that, I think she is young and attractive. She's got a great story, whichever story it is being told. She's got several great stories.
Yeah, depending on what day it is.
Right. She's got good story. She worked hard for it. I mean, she went out and the other guy didn't. And I think there is a mood. You remember the whole prediction was they're going to just take their masks off and say, yeah, I am a socialist. And there's nothing wrong with that because this system isn't working.
Yeah. And that's what she's saying.
And that's what she's saying.
Exactly what she's saying.
And so people who don't know, well, wait a minute. That's because we haven't been doing what our founders have said we were supposed to do. We're not that anymore. We haven't been that in a very long time. They just assume that this is discredited. But really what's discredited is this hybrid version of a big state government control and, you know, the tip of the hat to the Bill of Rights. That's what doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody's asking her, you know, her line continues to be when she's asked, what's the difference between democratic socialism and socialism? Or what's the difference between those and just being a Democrat? And the only thing I've ever heard her explain is that, Well, in a country that's the wealthiest and most prosperous in the world, there shouldn't be any poor. Well, I mean, welcome to utopia. Yes, that's, we'd all love that. However, we know that you can't eradicate poverty completely from the face of the earth. There's just no way to do that. So how are you proposing to pay for everybody having a free education, free health care, guaranteed job, and a guaranteed place to live?
But see what you just did. You're making a point on her. Say, you're uh-huh. making a point on her answer. She didn't answer your
right.
question.
That's right.
She didn't even answer.
This is
you're
very
saying,
true.
What's the difference? And she answers it one way, and you.
And then I start down that road.
Start down that road.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. What's the difference?
What's the difference between that? I mean, Lenin is the guy who came up with democratic socialism.
Yeah.
We're democratic socialists. We're not communists. He used that in the 1919 revolution because the people were afraid of communism.
Because then it was scary to them.
It was scary. So we are mm-hmm. democratic socialists. That's where that comes so from. It's only democratic once. All right, I want to talk to you a little bit about a class that we're doing. The Palm Beach letter is a great investment letter, and Tika Tiwari is their cryptocurrency guy. Now, Tika is the guy that I had come into our offices, I don't know, about 5-6 months ago. And he's a really big expert in this. And Stu and I sat down with him and said, okay, so help me, because we don't really understand it. And we were really trying to understand so we could explain it to you. He was so great at explaining it. We asked him if he could do a course for the audience. And we've been talking about that. Well, this is something that we're going to do next Thursday, and it's absolutely free. All you have to do is just sign up, just register at beckcryptoshow.com. There's going to be an exclusive live conversation with me, a studio audience. You can get your questions in as well with Tika, and he's going to be explaining a ton of stuff, including not just how it works, why it works. He's going to be talking about the technology that is going to change the world of cryptocurrency. Also show you why he thinks this year in cryptocurrency is going to be bigger than it was last year. Go to beckcryptoshow.com. Pat said this morning, geez, I wish I would have invested when it was $300. He says now is that time again. BeckCryptoShow.com. Go there. Again, it's free. You just have to register. It's happening next Thursday, a week from tomorrow. BeckCryptoShow.com. There is another problem coming out of the Houston School District. If you remember, Houston School District, wasn't it Houston that had the problem with the superintendent, or was that Katy?
Yeah, it was Katy, but that's suburban Houston.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now there is a new problem at a school. It was a field trip with 6th grade girls.
22 of them were strip searched on this field trip because one of the teachers on the trip was missing $50. So they stripped 22 6th grade girls down to their bra and panties. And searched for the missing $50 to find out who had stolen it.
And nobody had.
Not one of them. They didn't find the $50.
I wonder if the kids were allowed to strip search the adults.
He doesn't say that in the story, so my guess is no. But after it went missing, a police officer working at the Lanier Middle School informed the school's assistant principal that girls sometimes like to hide things in their bras and panties. So that's why they strip searched them. So then they loosened their bras, checked around the waistband of their panties, and found no money. So
can you
how
imagine
livid as a parent would you be if this was your daughter?
This is Texas.
Sad how many of these things are taking place in Texas.
Texas is close. Texas is on the edge.
Well, that's why they're worried about this blue wave thing.
I know.
I think Texas is close. There's all these people that are moved from California, all these companies that have moved in. Texas is, you know, number one with business now.
We should have built a wall on our western border a long time ago.
A long time ago.
Keep the Californians out.
And the northern border.
Yep.
You know, not Canada. Oklahoma.
Yes. Stay out. We're closed.
Yeah. I mean, it's changing here dramatically, and that's not good. We'll give you the stats on Texas here in just a second on what Texas means to America just on business, because we are different than the other 49 states. But it's changing here in Texas. Back in a minute.
All right. What are you doing on July 19th? Got anything planned? Well, cancel it if you do, because you need to be involved in this really cool online free live investment training broadcast event on July 19th. You can register at BeckCryptoShow.com. Glenn's going to be hosting it along with Tika Tiwari from Palm Beach Letter. It's basically a way to get you from zero to 60 on cryptocurrencies. What do you need to learn? What do you need to understand? And it's going to go deeper than that as well, because it's going to go into the idea of the new case for Bitcoin. What's coming on the horizon? Also, what are the three cryptocurrencies that Tika Tiwari recommends you buy right now? That's a list you definitely want to have. Plus, they've got this thing going on, Palm Beach Letter's exclusive $2 million Bitcoin giveaway. I know I want to be registered in that. I don't think they're going to allow me, but I'm going to try anyway. Make sure you don't miss out this opportunity. Go to BeckCryptoShow.com and register now for this exclusive broadcast event. Register now for free, BeckCryptoShow.com. It's BeckCryptoShow.com.
So let me, before we get back into Texas and what it means in Texas to the rest of the country to have Texas a free state, let me give you the first real casualty here. It seems in the trade war with China, it looks like it's Tesla. Tesla already having a problem with their with their manufacturing. Tesla was hit with a price tariff by the Chinese of 20%. They backed their price down and they went up another 10%. And so there's nothing they can do. Now, Tesla tariff is 40%.
Wow.
Tesla's a huge, huge market.
Was it doing well in China?
China is a huge,
expensive cars.
Yes. It was $2 billion last year.
Wow.
China was their second biggest market. If they lose China, they could go under. Now, let me ask you, because this is the way the economy actually works. The idea is to save jobs here and to keep manufacturing here. What would Tesla do? Tesla will either lose $2 billion and possibly fold because it's their second largest market, or move manufacturing to China and make their cars in China. They could make them here for here and make them over there for them. Which do you think they're going to do? Go out of business? Or move their manufacturing? This is why trade tariffs just don't work.
Yep.
They don't. They don't protect anybody. And you can see it. You can see it. It's not necessarily, if you think of tariffs as a tax, then you can understand that if you build things or make things in California, your taxes are so high, what do people do? They move. If your regulation and your taxes are high, you move to a place to where the regulation allows you to do business. That's been the secret of Texas. Is this from Forbes? This is what's this?
CNBC.
CNBC. They've been doing this for 12 years. Texas has won the top spot for best place to do business 4 times out of 12 years. So give me the stats on this.
They say that this is that we went back to the top of the list because of the rising tide of energy prices. When oil is still the number one industry here, But it's not just oil that's doing really well in Texas. We actually had GDP growth in the fourth quarter last year of 5.2%.
Holy cow.
5.2%. We are responsible for 1 in 7 jobs being added throughout the nation. So for every 7 jobs that happened in the country, Texas contributed one of them.
Actually, that's, you know what? That's good for America. Do you remember under Obama, the first couple of years, Texas was over 50% of all,
yep,
all jobs.
Yep. We've added more than 350,000 jobs in Texas in the last year. Kind of turbocharging our $1.6 trillion economy. I think we'd be 10th or 11th in the world in GDP, the state of Texas.
You mean
California?
We would be if people would, yes, stop denying that we're our own country.
Yes. So we're Texas is home to 39 companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, including AT&T, ExxonMobil, Texas Instruments, and some of the biggest privately held companies, too, including HEB, Neiman Marcus, Hunt Oil. They also say that we did really well in other categories of competitiveness. We were 7th in workforce, number 1 in infrastructure, number 9 in technology and innovation, and access to capital, we were 3rd. So in virtually every metric, we're at least top 10, and in many cases, the number 1 state in the country.
So what's number 2? And number, give me the top 5.
This will probably surprise you a little bit. Number 2 is Washington, Washington State. I don't think I would have ever guessed that. At 3rd is...
Wait, I'm mm-hmm. having a hard time getting my arms around that because you have Seattle. Now, maybe it's because you have Eastern Washington that balances things out.
Their economy was the fastest growing in the nation last year at 4.4%. That was for the full year.
Just like to remind you what my grandmother said before I moved away.
Uh-huh.
Glenn, tell everyone you meet, it rains there all the time. And I said, Grandma, I don't have a problem saying that because it does. And she said, mm-hmm. Good. Now you don't have to lie. She was trying to get people to not move to the Seattle area and wreck it.
Now, one of the problems, though, that you might imagine Washington has is $13.8 billion in unfunded pension obligations. So the pension thing is killing Washington State, just like it is Illinois, Massachusetts, and other states.
What are we going to do when those pensions go belly up?
Mm-hmm.
The states have to pay them, and they go to the United States government, and the United States government says, we'll bail you out.
How is the United States government going to pull that off, though? I don't understand how that... You know, bankrupt the federal government then, too.
And do I, as a citizen of another state, that, I mean, you want to talk about taxation without representation. I didn't vote for those pensions.
Right.
We didn't accrue that debt. Why are you giving my tax money to them for the debt that they racked up?
You think that's going to be a problem?
Yeah, I do.
When California comes knocking on the door of the federal government to bail them out? And Illinois and
New York
and Washington. No, people aren't going to be happy about that. Utah at number 3. So they rose 5 places from last year. Job growth was about 3.4% in Utah. They actually beat Texas on a percentage basis. The Silicon Slopes tech region is thriving. 6,500 startups and tech companies now are based in Utah. That's amazing. And then there's demand for housing, and that fuels construction. And so all of that's happening. Utah added 50,000 jobs last year, which is a 3.4% increase. Then you've got Colorado, which is back for the first time in a while in the top 5. Some of the biggest movers on this list, New York actually jumped from 38th to 27th. So they actually improved. They were the most improved because apparently their finances are in better shape now. The housing market is strong And only California is home to more Standard & Poor's 500 companies.
Where's California?
California is somewhere in the middle of the pack. There.
I'm telling you, if California didn't have perfect weather, no one would live there.
Yes, it wouldn't even be in the top 50 of the 50 states.
No one would live
you
there.
You just would not go.
Yeah, there is so much that people give up and they're just like, I just love the weather and I just love the weather. And I think that you just kind of give up after a while. You know,
I mean, the weather,
traffic,
though, is great.
The traffic is awful and the taxes are awful. The people are pretty nasty. And I don't really want
to. Then there's mudslides and earthquakes
and when the
fires.
Fire, but
the weather, know,
the weather is great. I mean, it's just. Tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's Goldline. Pat, crack one of these open. This is now 2 ounces of silver, and it's like a credit card.
It's almost the exact same size as a credit card, right?
Right.
And you want me to?
You can crack it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a Kit Kat, except it's made out of pure silver. Now, these are individual bars. They make up this one, and then it makes up 19 individual bars that make up 2 ounces of silver. So you can break it apart, as Pat is doing. Do it by your microphone so people can actually hear. But you can, you snap it apart, and that is able now to be used as currency, and it is made by the Canadian Mint. So it obviously it just looks like a square coin.
They're really beautiful too.
Yeah, made by the Canadian Mint. This is the Maple Flex. Is the 4 9s pure silver bar on the market. It's the only bar of its kind. It's the only one that can be separated into 19 legal tender coins. It does have the picture of the Queen on it, which
you could take or leave, and a maple leaf.
And a maple leaf, which I could also kind of take or leave.
Yeah.
Get it?
I got it.
Anyway, so what you do, you buy these, and you know they come in packs. They're very affordable. I don't even know what they are, like $20, I think, for one of these. Same price as credit card, check, or bank wire. Qualifying orders can take advantage of the unique price shield program, but it's pure silver, and it is definitely something that you should have. In case there is a serious meltdown, something is never going to happen. Let's just say states start to, default on their pensions.
That's ridiculous.
I know it is.
How could that happen?
It's not going to happen. Anyway, you should call Goldline now. 1-866-GOLDLINE. 1-866-GOLDLINE. Read their important risk information and find out if it's right for you. It is right for my family. Check it out yourself. 1-866-GOLDLINE. Call them right now. This is how split our culture is. Back in the 1960s, the Beatles had, 4 out of the top 10?
They had all five of the top 5 in the country. So they had Can't Buy Me Love was number 1, Twist and Shout 2, and number 3, She Loves You. 4th was I Want to Hold Your Hand, and number 5 was Please Please Me.
Okay, so.
All the top 5.
Those are all songs, if you're our age, if you're my age, you know them. If you're 30, you probably have at least heard them. Everybody, it was a cultural revolution.
Yep.
Somebody has just broken this record.
Yeah.
Don't say the name.
They smashed the record. They've got 7 in the top 10. He's got number 1, number 2, number 4, number 6, 7, 8, and 9 songs in the country right now.
In this country?
Yes.
In this country.
Okay. On the Billboard Hot 100
Now, the
chart.
Reason why I said in this country is... I know I'm going to sound like a really old guy here, but everyone knew the Beatles. You could not escape the Beatles. But we are such a country that is now, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, but we can all find our own stuff and we can cut ourselves out of giant movements. This is obviously a giant movement of some sort. I've never heard of him.
Drake? Rapper. I've heard of him. I don't think I've ever heard one of his songs. I don't.
Marissa, is this like Is this like, is he everywhere? You don't know? You're...
I don't know.
Really? Not, you're not familiar with Drake either?
I mean, I'm familiar with him. I don't. Yeah.
How old are you? 20?
25.
25?
Yeah. He's everywhere. I don't listen to him.
Okay. Wow.
And is he any good?
Not. I mean, I would rather listen to the Beatles, personally.
Okay.
He's okay.
So, but you're not a huge rap
fan.
He's no
Kanye West with his new album.
Yeah, well.
Well, who is? Well, who
Scoop.
Is?
I mean,
come on.
You can't
make up those lyrics.
No, you can.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't want to.
Yeah.
And listen to this. Not only does he have 7 of the top 10, he right now has 27 songs overall in the Hot 100. 27% of the chart are Drake songs. How is that even possible?
I got to listen to some.
Yeah, I have to hear what he sounds like now. His new album, Scorpion, debuted at number 1. All 25 tracks from that album are on the Hot 100, plus 2 more, obviously. So he's now charted 186 songs over the course of his career, which I don't know how many years that spans.
So the Billboard chart, if I'm not mistaken, Billboard is just from sales, not radio play.
It used to be that way. I'm not sure that's still the case.
Does radio play even matter?
I think radio play does factor into Billboard. I think. But it's incredible. It's because people don't listen. They don't even listen to music the same way they used to with Mm-mm. Spotify and Pandora. Mm-mm. And you know, music on demand, you can listen to any song you want at any time you want now. It's not like you're held hostage by music radio anymore. So this is even a bigger accomplishment, I think, because of that. That's just his the number 1 song in the country, Nice for What. Number 2, Nonstop. Number 4, God's Plan. Number 6, In My Feelings. I'm Upset. Number 7, Emotionless. Number 8, and Don't Matter to Me, featuring Michael Jackson. Number 9.
So wait, give me the names again, because it seems they seem to be diametrically opposed to each other.
Mm-hmm. Nice for What? Mm-hmm. Nonstop. God's Plan.
Mm-hmm.
In My Feelings.
Okay, In My Feelings.
I'm Upset.
I'm Upset.
Emotionless.
But I have no emotions.
I'm emotionless.
Yeah, I'm emotionless.
And Don't Matter to Me.
And it doesn't matter.
Don't Matter to Me. I got to listen to some of these, because to beat the Beatles record, you should have to be pretty exceptional. And I don't know any rap like that, frankly.
Now, it may be.
I'm not the target demo there.
You may not be the target.
Do you think that's possible?
Yes. But I would at least expect somebody who has 27% of the Hot 100 on Billboard, I would expect would be so culturally relevant that everyone would at least go, oh, yeah, I think I know that guy.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.